From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Whether you love it, like it, or think it's a waste of money, California's criticized, delayed, and budget-busting high-speed rail is moving forward. The ambitious transportation project spans governors and will take decades to be completed, not to mention constant and significant state and federal funding to realize its potential. The end goal is for the bullet train to connect Los Angeles to San Francisco in its first phase, and then extend to San Diego and Sacramento in its second phase, and reshape the economy of Central Valley communities like Fresno and Bakersfield. We're going to get into all of that. We're going to dedicate a lot of time today to the future of high-speed rail in California. First up is the CEO of High-Speed Rail, Brian Kelly. Good afternoon. Thank you for making the time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So I think a lot of Californians are familiar with high-speed rail, but it does have a lot of history. I mean, it goes back to 2008. California voters, approved a $10 billion bond to fund high-speed rail from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Now the estimates is that it could cost upwards of $128 billion to complete. The first passengers could be maybe a decade from now. It was supposed to be running by 2020, if you go back to the 2008 ballot measure. What do you say to Californians who ask, you know, it's taken a lot of time, why continue to spend this kind of money on a project when the state is already facing a lot of other issues?
Well, I think the short answer is because of what the project will mean for Californians. I mean, today, if you want to take a passenger rail train from San Francisco to Los Angeles, that is a 12.5-hour train ride on a diesel-emitting, slow-moving train. And if you want to drive it, as you know, it's 7 or 8 hours on, you know, typically on I-5. That doesn't really connect the coastal areas of the state with the true cities and economic centers of the Central Valley. And what this project is proposing to do is connect the economic centers of the L.A. Basin and the Bay Area with the Central Valley and some of the rich history of those cities and communities in the Central Valley, and get from point A to point B in 3 hours. It also does it on electrified, clean, renewable-powered system. And so I still think there's a prospect here that people support. The polling we've done shows that people support it. And really, I mean, I've been doing transportation policy in California for 30 years. And what we've always tried to do is when we look at each dollar spent in transportation, you want to know, does it help mobility? Does it help the economy? Does it help the environment? And does it help with accessibility? And the answer on this project is it scores high on each of those four. And that will always be the case. So yes, it is expensive. It's going to take time to do. We're well on our way to getting it done. We just got a major and important reinvestment from the federal government. But I think the short answer is because it's the right thing to do for California's future.
You know, if someone who voted for this back in 2008 is like, okay, 2020 has come and passed, you know, it's been more than a decade, why aren't there passengers yet?
Yeah. Well, look, there's a lot of lessons learned here, and we've learned the hard ones. I came here in 2018, and we were living with the legacy of really what I think were some unfortunate steps in the beginning. And I say this without blaming any of my predecessors, but the reality is a couple of things that I think we could have done better collectively. One, we should not have gone to the voters and asked for only $9 billion for a project that even at that time we said cost $45 billion. Because partially funding something and then putting a date by which it's going to be done is a recipe for trouble. And then secondly, when the federal government did give us funding for it back in 2008 and 2009, they had some extremely aggressive expenditure date requirements, deadlines by which you had to spend that money. That encouraged the authority to get into construction before it was ready. And that means trying to start construction before you have all the right-of-way, before you moved all the utilities. You never want to start a mega project that way. And so, but the good news is we're moving past that legacy, right? The project is so much more defined today. The dollars that have come in, more federal dollars coming in now, stabilized a bit the state funding. There's still more to do. But we have a definite phasing structure that recognizes the constraints on our budget and says, let's start this in the Central Valley where we first got the federal dollars, and then let's expand to the Bay Area and to Southern California. So I guess I would say I'm not sure I would start any project the way this one started. And that's a lesson beyond just the construction. It's all of it. But we have this. We still have the prospects of doing something great. While it costs more than the original estimates, it's still completely in line with what high-speed rail costs across the globe. And more importantly, an electrified high-speed train that can reduce that travel time so dramatically is much more efficient, cost-efficient, than expanding freeways and expanding airports. And that's the alternative. So for all those reasons, it's important to go. But there's been a lot of lessons learned that if we could do it differently, turn back the clock, I would. But you can't. And so now you take it from here and you move forward.
Yeah, right. Because you haven't been here since the beginning. I mean, you came on in 2018. You've been here for 6 years. And, you know, high-speed rail has been subject to audits from the state about mismanagement, lack of oversight, you know. What did you inherit in 2018? I mean, taking this on.
Yeah, I mean, it was tough when I stepped into it. It was a project that I think, again, because it had started construction before right-of-way and utilities were moved, it had seen some delays because the contractors were held up. They couldn't go to work. And therefore, they have delay claims against you, the state in that case. And then we had to do the hard work of getting that right-of-way done, getting those utilities moved. But even the precursor to that is making sure that you have all the designs done so you know what right-of-way you need. And so just to give you a number on this, when I started in 2018, you know, the first 119 miles that we have in construction right now in the Central Valley, it needed 163 what we call ready-for-construction design packages. And at that time, 18 were done. You know, today, 163 are done, right? So you didn't have a well-defined project when I stepped in, and therefore you had a lot of indecision and trouble in moving right away and moving utilities. Now, today, those design packages are done. 98.5% of the right away is complete. About 83% of the utilities are either moved or are being moved. And we are expanding construction every day. So it's a different place today, and that's just a credit to people who all the staff and the work and the board who just rolled up their sleeves and went to work.
Yeah, I mean, you're really talking about the nitty-gritty, you know, and that's not always, you know, sexy. That's kind of hard to get across to everyday Californians. You know, given that, you know, it's taken so long and the audits, you know, that kind of erodes public trust. Do you think high-speed rail has like a PR issue, that a messaging issue?
Well, I think it has, but I also think the only counter to that I know is to be very candid about where you are. And so I really feel like since I stepped in, if I could just, you know, take 1 minute, but, you know, before I took this job, I worked in transportation and other capacities, and I learned an important lesson from another mega project, the replacement of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. That had some issues as well, both on cost and time and all those things. But one of the things I learned on that project in that process, which really drove me coming here, was I think we tend to sometimes not give the public enough credit. And I think what I came to this and what I learned on the Bay Bridge is I think the public knows that big mega projects are going to have challenges. And I think they know that because many in the public have remodeled a bathroom or remodeled a kitchen, and they ran into things they weren't expecting. Now you times that by a million, right? And so they know there's going to be challenges. I think what's important for the agency to do and the government that's trying to deliver that project is to be extremely candid about what those challenges are and what you're going to do about them. And I think that's a fair agreement between what we're doing and what the public expects, and that is the way to operate. So when I came in here, we put out reports that were very candid. You know, here's where we are, here's what we need, here's some mistakes we made early. We put that out. We called it lessons learned. And the good news for us today is that we now apply those lessons learned, and you take steps to make sure they're not repeated. And just to give you one more example, and then I'll move on. But you know, I talked about not getting the right-of-way done and not moving the utilities before we started construction. And now for the extensions, we're now extending the initial 119 miles to 171 miles so we can connect cities, Merced, Fresno, Bakersfield. And to do that, we are now sequencing the work properly. Like we are finishing all the design now. Start buying all the right-of-way now. Don't go into construction contracts until that is done. That will save a lot of problems later. But this project had to learn that, and we did.
Yeah, as I mentioned, the first phase of this project, which is going to take years and years and years, is from Los Angeles to San Francisco. But the first leg that high-speed rail is actively working on, you mentioned the Central Valley. It's going to be from Bakersfield to Merced. The projection for it to be ready is anywhere between like 2030 and 2033. Critics have called it the train to nowhere. Why start the first phase here from Bakersfield to Merced?
Yeah, I think that criticism was at one time merited when you only talked about the 119 miles, because at 119 miles, and let's just be clear on the history here, the state of California back in 2008 applied for federal funds to start construction after the bond bill was passed. And there were four applications, including different places around the state to start. When the federal government gave the state money to start advancing this project, they wanted it to start in a disadvantaged community.
And this was the Obama administration.
It was.
And this is during the Great Recession.
It was. And they wanted it to start, and they wanted the economic benefits to begin in a place that was economically challenged, and also, in this case, an area that had some air quality issues, which the Central Valley had both, and based on poverty rates was amongst the worst in the country. And so they chose, of the four applications the state submitted, they gave federal funds to the first 119 miles in the Central Valley. Now, the 119 miles was from a town of Madera to literally a place called Poplar Avenue, which is essentially an orchard. So you may start construction there, but that's nowhere to run a train. And I think what changed when I came in and with Governor Newsom coming in is, how do you define more value out of this in the Central Valley? How do you get it from being a train to nowhere to a train to somewhere? And that's when we collectively came up with, let's extend that 119 into the cities. So now we're going to the three of the fastest growing cities in California: Merced, Fresno, Bakersfield. It's 171 miles. If we don't build this today in the early 2030s, the estimate is that rail ridership in the Central Valley will be about 2.8 million riders a year. With this, the rail and transit ridership in the region will be about 7.5 million. So we think it's worth doing. And it makes much more sense to build the infrastructure for a viable operating train. And that's got to get into the cities. It's got to get into the downtowns. So that's what we've taken on now, and that's what we're hoping to get operational in the early part of 2030.
And if it's the early part of 2030s for just this stretch alone, you know, for the first phase from Los Angeles to San Francisco, when can we expect someone, you know, taking the entire route?
Well, that's a question of funding. And so the entire route all the way to Los Angeles and into the Bay Area will involve tunneling through mountain regions, and that's not easy. But we have to pursue additional funding for that. So how we are operating this now in terms of our vision and the way we are moving forward, the Central Valley is the center of really our focus, because that's where we're building structures. We just got grants to buy trains, to expand our work into Merced and Bakersfield. And so that's really the focus of getting ready for rail operations. We have completed the environmental work almost by June of this year. All segments from downtown San Francisco to downtown Los Angeles will be environmentally cleared. And today, about 422 miles are cleared. So we'll do the final 41 to our board in a couple of months this year. So then we'll have cleared all of that, and we want to start advanced design work into the Bay Area and into LA while we're getting operational in the Valley. But the ultimate schedule to solve all of this and get this done will require us going back and getting more funding, both at the state level, the federal level, and maybe some private contributions, because there'll be a interest from private operators at that point. So we're taking this in phases: Central Valley first, likely Bay Area, SoCal, and we just keep doing the work, and that's where we are.
When it comes to federal funding, I mean, as you know, it hinges on federal funding. Recently, the Biden administration, you know, infused about $3 billion into this project, but it ebbs and flows with politics. So we yes. are in an election year, and we've already had the experience of having different presidents during this time of this project. Is there a contingency plan, given that it really hinges on having this federal support, and if the administration or even getting bipartisan support from Congress is difficult to come by?
It is, you know, it's impossible to build a mega project, a public works project, and de-link it from politics. It just doesn't happen. What we've been really trying to do is, you know, as I said, define our work better, perform better, and be very aggressive on pursuing funding. And we developed a five-year, $8 billion strategy on federal funds since the passage of what's called the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And in the first 2 years of that, we've now received $3.4 billion. So we're going to keep going back and keep being aggressive on federal funding. I've been asked many times, I mean, there's a great line about mega projects that says, you know, delivering a mega project is like surviving a series of near-death experiences, right? And that's absolutely true. And there was a time when I was asked, how are you going to survive the Trump administration? And then I was asked, how are you going to survive the McCarthy speakership? And we're still here. And we're still here because all I know to do and all my team knows to do is do the work and keep our performance up and hit the milestones that we say we're going to hit. And that's what we've been doing. The politics tend to take care of themselves when you have more success. So our job is to have more success. And then we'll see what happens with the politics. So I can't predict the future. I've experienced the toughness of different administrations. We've found a way to get through it. We're deeply into this now in California. To me, there is no wisdom or choice in saying just stop, because then you're going to have just a bunch of monuments to failure.
Skeletons.
And that's not in anybody's interest. So we should get at least that first initial operating segment done. Let's make a judgment on whether it's still worth doing the whole thing. To me, it's a no-brainer. I think San Francisco to LA is absolutely right. But that's kind of the approach.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Brian Kelly, who is the CEO of California High Speed Rail. In the last few minutes that we have, I want to touch upon a parallel project that's taking place. This is linking Los Angeles to Las Vegas, and this is a private project, and it just got $3 billion as well from the federal government. The hope is that it'll be completed by the 2028 Olympics in LA. So when I hear or read that, some people may have the question, 2028 for this stretch, why does it take so long to get the stretch from Bakersfield to Merced?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot there. So the first part is, I think we have to be careful about how we describe the project. It was at one time an idea to be an all-private project, but it just got $3 billion in public taxpayer money. So it is now a public-private project. And the reason I say that is there's been a lot of attempts around the country in different states to start high-speed rail with the thought that we'll just do it with private money. But the capital involved to build these systems makes that nearly impossible. And I think Brightline, which is the entity running the proposed Vegas to LA route, I think they just proved that. You know, they've got a good system and they've got a good track record operating a rail in Florida. But they just proved that it's really hard to do this all private. Now, here's some things about that project that's different than ours. In the Central Valley.
Well, the landscape's different, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, for sure. But also in the Central Valley, we had to go buy 2,300 private parcels to build the alignment. They are building largely along the alignment of a freeway, and all they had to do was negotiate a land rights agreement with Caltrans. So that's different. I've had to go through CEQA and NEPA approvals. They have not had to go through CEQA approvals. They had a different environmental process. Those are benefits. They're building a single track. I'm building a double track. Mine is going through the heart of cities, including the city of Fresno, where, for example, I have to move about 1,000 utilities, right? They have much less of that because a lot of that stretch they're going through is fairly barren. You know, it's really the I-15 corridor. So it's a different thing. They're not yet in construction. They're getting there. And I'm rooting for that project because, to me, it's all the beginning of what I think you need to see in passenger rail, not just in California, but in America, which is let's get away from fossil fuel-based slow locomotive railroads and let's move to high-speed electric clean. And they represent that and we represent that. And I think our big thing going forward is where do we connect the services? How can my passengers help your service and your passengers help mine? And with the grant that we both received, we got $3.1 billion. They got $3 billion.
Does that make it competitive, though? Now that it's public-private, they can be going after the same federal funding that you would want for high-speed rail.
Yes. So I do think there's a competitive element. There's no doubt about that. But I would say, look, we applied for $3 billion. We got a little bit more than we applied for. We got $3.1 billion. They applied for about $3.7 billion, and they got $3 billion. The beauty of it all, though, is that this is an expression from our federal government, and you cannot build any new transportation system without a full federal partner. Both grants reflect a vision and a commitment to go do this. Do this in California, do it in Nevada, start there. I see this as being a longer-term thing where you're ultimately going to need an interstate highway kind of commitment from the federal government. That's going to be important to make this work. But I think that both awards are a good thing. And on balance, if you're one who believes that electrified, clean, high-speed rail is a good part of our transportation future, what the federal government did is good. Both the awards are good.
Finally, we only have a minute left, and you are soon to be the outgoing CEO of High Speed Rail after 6 years. Why are you heading out, and what advice do you have for whoever's going to fill your shoes?
Yeah, thanks for the question. When I took the job back in 2018, I told anybody who would listen I'd do it for about 3 to 5 years, and February 1st will be year 6. So, That was part of it. The other part is, especially with the federal grant that just came in, this project is now quickly moving into an operations project. We're going to buy trains. We're going to start talking about fares and schedules and all train interiors, all the things that are important to operating a railroad. And, you know, candidly, it's time to bring in somebody with that experience. You know, I wanted to stabilize the project. I wanted to get it to the next stage. But now is the right time to bring in, somebody who's run a passenger railroad system, in my view, and help us get through that next phase to get this thing going.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Brian Kelly is the now outgoing CEO for California High Speed Rail. Up next, we're going to continue our conversation about high speed rail and the potential it has to reshape the Central Valley. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We just heard from the head of California's high-speed rail about the economic benefits an ambitious transportation project could potentially deliver to the state, specifically the Central Valley. The route will include a more than 100-mile stretch track between Merced and Bakersfield. And while some people, including elected leaders in California, still snicker at the project, for a lot of people in the Central Valley, the train isn't just a pipe dream. It's an opportunity for huge investment to their region. Yusef Baig is the commentary editor for Cal Matters, and that's a nonprofit newsroom which partners with public media stations across the state. And Yusef joins us now about his reporting on how high-speed rail could help reshape the future of the Central Valley. Good afternoon. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks, Vicki. Great to be here.
Well, you took the trip to the Central Valley. You share the voices of people that this stands to benefit when completed. What inspired you to explore the impact of high-speed rail in the Central Valley?
Yeah, so it was actually kind of a couple things. I mean, I've reported around sustainability, growth issues for several years, and high-speed rail just touches so much of that. And how I found myself kind of watching this project unfold over the years, I became more curious over time. Last summer, I was watching a panel, and there was this comment that really stuck with me. It was from an advocate named Carter Lavin, and he said, it feels like we've lost the plot on high-speed rail, and I just couldn't let that go. And another aspect of it, too, is, I've been reading coverage for so long, and it always seemed like it was dictated by someone based in L.A. or the Bay Area or Sacramento, right? But it always kind of had what felt like a bias built into it. And, this lack of recognition that You know, there's a migration pattern that's changing in California. I mean, people are moving into the Central Valley. Some of the biggest population changes are happening in the San Joaquin Valley. And even state forecasters are projecting that 5 million new residents will be there by 2060. And so this is absolutely a hub that is transforming. And it felt like the conversation was just skewed in the wrong direction.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's easy to be cynical about one politics or government or transportation as well. You know, and when you're talking about the Central Valley and how fast it's growing, I mean, even today, the population of Fresno is 500,000 people. That's the same population as like the city of Sacramento. And you speak to people in Fresno and their hopes and what they hope this project will accomplish. One of them is actually a business owner, Morgan Doizaki. And before we meet him, we're going to listen to him. But just tell us about him. What stands out to you about him?
Yeah, well, his family has owned Central Fish Market. It's like at the doorstep of Southwest Fresno from the downtown area. And they've been there for 7+ decades. I mean, just a historic shop, a place that's been in their family for generations. And his family is actually originally from Japan. And so his mother used to tell him stories about the Shinkansen, which is the bullet train there. It was the very first in the world, and this really pioneering project. And so his family just has like a very interesting view of not just bullet trains, but this project in general, right? Because now it's suddenly at their doorstep and he's looking at what this might actually do for his community.
Well, let's take a listen to him.
They're like, oh, it's a train to nowhere. Oh, a big taxpayer dollar waste of money. But this is our time right now. So you're going to see a lot of Fresno, 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 Fresno. And it's going to keep on happening because it is our time right now.
Yeah, you could definitely hear the hope and anticipation. You know, what does he think and other business owners like him that the fact that this project has been delayed? It was supposed to be completed by 2020.
Well, it's really having a legitimate impact on their businesses because right now streets are torn up, sidewalks are impassable. So you're even having some of the most loyal customers to these retails, shops and businesses starting to rethink whether they can even make it there some days. And so it's having a direct impact on their business bottom line, but it's also kind of just affecting the overall look and makeup of the community, right? I mean, it's really difficult when you have dozens of brownfields and fenced off properties. You have, businesses that need foot traffic, just not necessarily getting it right now because you have this historic construction track that cuts right through the community and separates it from downtown. And so they're really in kind of a holding pattern and a bit of limbo, just kind of waiting eagerly for this project to arrive for the downtown station to finally be built.
When you talk to local elected officials, one of them was the mayor of Fresno. That's Jerry Dyer, also a former Fresno police chief. He is conservative. And I think over the years, a lot of the criticism, at least politically, does come from the conservative arm of elected officials. Before we listen to him, tell us what you learned about him. I mean, does he fall in line with that?
He surprisingly doesn't. And given that, he's a fiscal conservative, he has even gone to war with his council over grant funding for Planned Parenthood. He is, a proper Republican, a former police chief, right? But he describes himself as a big proponent of this project. And I think he sees this in a much more pragmatic way than maybe folks who are in the state house or in Washington, D.C. might, in that he views it as something that can be a boon for businesses, can bring new residents, which then turn into new revenue and all these different ways that the economy can actually be built up. And one thing he told me that I thought was really interesting is he doesn't want to be the mayor that's remembered for blowing this opportunity.
Let's take a listen.
And so that's what I share with folks in the community, that this is our time. This is our time to get reconnected to the state of California, to the bigger cities of Los Angeles, to San Francisco, San Jose, ultimately maybe Las Vegas, should things work out. And I think this is going to stimulate our economy locally like it never has been done before.
Yeah, I mean, that really illustrates that, when the funding came in, as the CEO of High Speed Rail said, this was during the Obama administration. This was during the Great Recession. They really focused on the Central Valley. So it would not be the best decision to just leave that money on the table, especially that's his viewpoint. Now that the money is there, has there already been some kind of revitalization taking place in Fresno and areas like it?
Yeah, there's about $300 million in total from the state and federal government that have been allocated to Fresno to upgrade infrastructure, repair old systems, things like that. And there's also been kind of an economic lens in which the state has been looking at it as like, okay, this is an area that is strategically a place we want to invest in. We want to see new housing. We want to make it a bit more eco-friendly, you know, build tree canopies, you know, repair sidewalks, signage, things like that, that give it sort of a cultural significance. And so one of the first projects that was part of that is already open. It's called the Monarch. It's a 57-unit affordable housing building. It's very flashy, very trendy, but it kind of in many ways sort of signifies what this community might be seeing in the years to come.
Yeah. I mean, when we say revitalization, that's tricky. And there are some really hard learning lessons in areas that have been revitalized. You can have displacement alongside gentrification. I mean, these areas are home to generations long immigrant communities in the Central Valley. I mean, what about equity? How are they ensuring that the people who have lived there for a long time, like that business owner, the market owner, you know, that he and people like him don't get displaced?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a concern with projects like this. I mean, something that Sacramento saw with Aggie Square, right? You had the community that, you know, they filed a lawsuit after they organized just to make sure there was a community benefits agreement. And what I think is interesting about Chinatown is they've almost kind of found a blueprint, I think, for what could be done for big projects like this. They all came together, they created this unified front, and they started bargaining. They kind of forced their way to the table, in a sense, to say, hey, like, we're going to be part of these discussions. We want to have a role in planning, envisioning, and sort of looking at the future. And that's actually really helped them be sort of a presence in these discussions, not just with local officials, but with state officials as well. And so now they're in a position where, instead of having them being dozed or moved out, they're actually having an opportunity to say, no, we're going to upgrade this community, and we're going to give the people who have been here a chance to actually be a part of the future.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking all about high-speed rail. We're digging in to the economic impact potential, specifically in the Central Valley, with our guest, Yusuf Beg with CalMatters. When you talk to people in the Central Valley, I know you gave a heavy focus to Fresno. They obviously can understand and appreciate the potential, but when it comes to optimism, where are they with it actually coming to fruition and being completed within a reasonable amount of time?
Yeah, I mean, I think Fresno is kind of, they're feeling better because they're seeing some of this already, right? Whereas other parts of the Central Valley, they're waiting for a lot of these dollars to come in. They're waiting to actually see some of this. I mean, when you drive down the 99, you'll see some of these viaducts, right? There's structures all over the place. I mean, it's starting to become real and visible, but, you know, this is also still a deep red part of the state. Some of the safest Republican seats in Congress and in the state house are in this region of California. And so it's a place that the politics are always going to be skeptical of projects like this. And I think some of the most influential voices here, folks who are in agriculture, who have been tethered to these communities for a long time, they still are having a lot more of a harder time imagining the benefits. They, you know, sold some of their land, opened up their parcels for this project to come through in the early stages. But the authority, like I think Brian noted, you know, was not very well run back in the day. And so it would be years before they would see money or some of these deals complete. And in the meantime, they're losing from the crop or the land that they don't get to utilize. And so there's a lot of, I think, bad political history that is affecting how some of the folks outside the urban areas are thinking. And so I think that's a calculation that state leaders are making when they're saying, hey, we're going to mirror those complaints probably more than what we might see in the cities and areas where it's actually happening.
And politics, it's still going to have an impact, you know, in the years and decades to come. I mean, when you talk to lawmakers in the area, whether either federal or state lawmakers that are trying to get some federal funding, what did you learn about the challenges of making that sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like Brian said, I mean, funding is everything for this project, and it's been a bit of an unsustainable relationship so far with the state source of income. It's been 85% of the project's funding has come from California, and that's just not how it happens with infrastructure projects, right? And so there's going to need to be a serious change in the way this project is funded going forward. There might be some signs that some of that is changing, right? Like, you're starting to see more projects in different parts of the country. The Brightline project that you guys were talking about, LA to Las Vegas, is one. There's already a project open, Miami to Orlando, that's also from Brightline. That's starting to get some attention and traction. And so Texas, Washington, other parts of the country are having high-speed projects move forward. And I think what might start to happen is, as ridership increases, as people start to experience these projects more and more in other places, you're going to see the political calculus change for some of the leaders. And I think that's going to make them more inclined to maybe be supportive and have more of this bipartisan support.
And despite this being an ambitious project, you know, unprecedented in some ways, I mean, California is known to take on ambitious projects, for it to get criticism, lawsuits, you know, the whole gamut, being delayed and costly. And you kind of look into the history and maybe and the learning lessons as well. I want to start with the Golden Gate Bridge. You spoke with Tony Tinoco. What did you learn from them?
Well, I think one of the things that I found, you know, writing about this project and talking to different people associated with it is like what's happening with high-speed rail is not necessarily unique. You know, there was a few examples that came to mind that I included in the piece. You know, the Central Subway in San Francisco, for example, it began service in 2022. It was more than $375 million over budget and 4 years late. The BART extension to San Jose is expected to cost double the price tag, opening 10 years later. The LA Metro Regional Light. I mean, I can go down the list of different transportation projects in California. I mean, this is a California problem, right? It's not so much a high-speed rail thing. And so when I talked to Tony, what she mentioned was one of the most iconic projects in California, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The Golden Gate Bridge. And I mean, you even talk about the Bay Bridge as well, and it had its hurdles. When you spoke with former Governor Jerry Brown, who was a big proponent for high-speed rail, I mean, he also kind of went, I guess, a little meta or something. It's like a reflection of the nation's stature. You know, this is symbolic of our investment, our belief, our trust in government and where that stands today. I mean, how do you see high-speed rail fitting into this broader narrative of national ambition, progress, and also just the public's trust in it?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at other parts of the world, right, we're envious of these bullet trains because they're already happening and people are moving so much faster and efficiently. They have more of their life, their free time available as a result of that. And so, for Governor Brown, it kind of signifies sort of this country standing in the world. Like, can we do big things? Can we be like China, where they're building tens of thousands of high-speed rail lines, or Japan that's, you know, decades ahead of the curve, or Spain, or, you know, just other parts of the world? And so if America wants to compete, this is a point he makes, if we want to compete on a global scale and have this sort of understanding and vision that others will want to look to, we have to be able to do stuff like this. And infrastructure is a very bread and butter type of thing.
In the last minute that we have, I mean, what are the next big steps for high-speed rail that you're going to be following and interested in seeing how it develops?
Yeah, so I mean, it's the timelines in place, right? So 2026 is when they're supposed to be done with this 119-mile segment in the Central Valley. And after that, they start the train tests in 2028 with the two manufacturers that they're deciding between. And then after that, we're talking about potentially seeing the public ride it in 2030. On the early side, more likely 32, 33, right? So it's just seeing if the project can actually meet these timelines and actually do what it needs to do politically, which is get more federal support.
If you don't live in that area, like that stretch from Bakersfield to Merced, or even, you know, the 100 plus mile stretch from Bakersfield through the Central Valley, what do you want them to take away from high-speed rail, from this conversation and this really big project that's going to move forward?
Yeah, I think when trains start running, we're going to look at this region a bit differently, and we're going to kind of be envious in the way we are of other countries around the world who have this and say, why not here? And I think if you're in San Francisco, LA, Sacramento, you're going to want to see this, especially as we talk about the climate, transportation overhaul, all the different things that California needs to do to be sustainable.
Yousef, thank you so much.
Thanks, Vicky.
Thanks for taking the trip to Fresno. Yousef Beg is the commentary editor for Cal Matters, which is a nonprofit newsroom that partners with public media stations across California. Still ahead, the world's longest running disability festival is making its way to Sacramento this weekend. We're going to learn about Superfest and how they prioritize access for filmgoers of all abilities. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It is the longest-running disability festival in the world, and this weekend it'll be in Sacramento. Superfest debuted in 1970, and in the 50-plus years since, has grown to an international film festival that celebrates cinema, which portrays disability through a diverse and complex lens, in a way that also prioritizes access for filmgoers of all abilities. This weekend, it's going to be in Sacramento. For the past 5 years, the Sacramento Public Library has partnered with Superfest. And this weekend, Superfest will showcase 10 films for both mature and family-friendly audiences. Kara Latham is the supervisor for the Ella K. McClatchy branch of the Sacramento Public Library. And Shayna Guraya is the co-director of Superfest. And they're joining us with more about the festival. It's taking place Sunday, January 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. virtually on Zoom. Good afternoon to you both. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kara, I want to start with you. How did the library become connected to Superfest?
We got involved after a librarian branch supervisor, Amber Fawn Wooten Clark, chose it, and we decided to bring it in as part of our equity statement and our focus on accessibility for everyone at the library and representing more of our diverse populations.
Hmm. Given that this is now going to be the fifth year, so obviously the response has been good. What makes a film festival like this unique? What has the response been from the Sacramento community?
Well, the community has been very responsive. I think Shayna can probably address this a little more closely. The festival itself is amazing and has people from all over the world both submitting and watching during the big festival, which is, I call it the big Superfest in San Francisco, the original. We're actually a showcase, which means that we only show a few of the films each year. We're more constrained with time and some of the ability to present it. So we have our own group here locally with the Braille and Talking Book Library, resources in independent living, California State Library, DDSO, and we get together and then we pick our own version of the larger festival.
Awesome. All right, Shayna, I want to get to you. You're a local. You're from Elk Grove. You're joining us from outside the area, though. Where did your love for film and creating cinema, where did it begin?
Yeah, I think it began as a kid. You know, my mom's from England and my dad's from India, so I grew up on a healthy diet of Bollywood and Doctor Who. And that was very much their way of, like, you know, exposing us to the cultures that we couldn't be a part of because we lived in America, right? And so from there, you know, I like to say that I got my start at Superfest through submitting a short film first. And that was in 2020, which I directed. And it was such a great experience because even though it was a virtual Zoom festival, there was so much engagement and thought put in. And I actually had someone help me get my first professional screenwriting job from that. And from there, Emily Badix, the co-director alongside me, kept inviting me to do panels throughout the year for different screenings for showcases. Similar to the Sacramento Superfest showcase. And then I was invited to be on the jury, and now I'm here as co-director. And so I say all this not to brag or anything, but it's really because the Superfest community doesn't just give you an acceptance of your film and then leave you to your own devices. The folks in the community really care and have formed such a support system and bond.
Yeah, it's certainly unique. I mean, and you capture that so well. If someone is just learning about Superfest in this conversation, how do you describe it to someone?
Yeah. So, you know, mainstream films about people with disabilities are usually told from a non-disabled point of view and can be very ableist. And so we're not about that at all. What makes us unique and stand apart is that we go beyond disability 101. That's the phrase we like to use. Superfest is more about upholding disability 201 and including films that push the disability conversation further than inspiration porn and surface level conversations of like, here's how I became disabled. An example of a topic we featured in the past is parenthood and disability and the nuances that go with that, even the societal barriers to access becoming a parent. And so that's what Superfest is all about. We're literally giving a platform to experiences that haven't been seen on screen before. And on top of that, we're inviting the filmmakers and actors with disabilities to come and be on panels about their films.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
That's wonderful. I mean, just taking in what you're saying, like through the perspective of typically, you know, in mainstream film through an ableist point of view, I mean, that's so limiting and there's so many blind spots that come with that. I mean, you have a background in film and TV production. You got your master's at USC. I mean, you wrote for the upcoming Netflix animated series. You're also a fellow of the Sundance's Institute for Accessible Futures Initiative, and that's incredible. So you are very much embedded into making meaningful strides in film to make it more inclusive for everyone of all abilities. Do you think there have been strides in recent years? You know, I think about what you just said, you know, having an actor play a person with, you know, who is experiencing or has a limitation or a disability instead of actually casting someone with that lived experience, or at the very least, not even consulting with someone who lives with that disability, you know, during the film's production. Have you been seeing like strides that are encouraging to you?
Yes, I've definitely been seeing strides that are encouraging to me. Otherwise, I would have become very jaded and not pursued this. But I think there are strides that are happening. However, the other component to that is those strides are happening because of our disabled community. And, you know, we see people like Keely Catt Wells, who are leaders in this field, who are helping to manage actors with disabilities and get them in roles such as The Last of Us. And we also see people like Nick Novicki, who run the Easter Seals Disability Film Challenge every year, where those short films make it into large festivals. And then we also have folks like the Inevitable Foundation, which I'm also a part of, which gives screenwriters with disabilities more engagement with executives who can really be the gatekeepers into the industry. And so, yes, I think we're getting into more rooms. There are more actors with disabilities working than before. However, we still are up against a lot of societal barriers and a lot of executives who just want big names to star in roles of disabled people, which is unfortunate. And so, you know, I have a lot of hope because there are some really rad folks out there putting in the good work. And Superfest is one part in a larger movement that just keeps growing.
Well, I want to get to Sunday because people can take in Superfest for themselves and watch 10 films, which is really incredible. So this event is actually going to be on Zoom, Kara. Explain why it's going to be on Zoom and what people should know if this is their first time they're going to take part in it.
Absolutely. One of the most important things is to go on to Sacramento Public Library, the website, and register, because without registration, you won't be able to get onto the Zoom to see the film.
So is there a cost?
There is no cost. It is absolutely free. It is available to anyone. There's no cap that I'm aware of. I should say that just I suppose it could explode, but I don't think it will get beyond the cap of being able to watch it. But we do have 10 wonderful films. It's always so hard to cull down. I'm sure Shana knows the same thing. You get these magnificent films and you only have so much time to be able to show them. And every year I've been a part of it since we started. And I do believe, by the way, we did Shana's film. I think it was one of the first ones we showed Shana, Wheelchair Wendy, which was a great, it's very applicable now too because it's Barbie. So it was a Barbie version. It was great. So we have the 10. You must register. You can register pretty late, but register first to get the link. And then it will be from 3 to 6 on Sunday, Zoom. They're just great. All of them, part of them was we chose the ones that the most that we could choose, of course, so they're short, but we were able to get the Best of Festival, so that's the As You Are one, and also my favorite this year, which was Colicide, which is a mosquito one. I have a thing with it. Last year there was one about a spider. So they're really great films. And we're also hoping to continue, the Sacramento Public Library is, in extending the awareness of the festival around and possibly having showings throughout the year. So at different libraries so that even more people can come in person and have that community.
Wonderful. Kara, thank you so much for joining us. I know Sunday's going to be great.
Thank you.
And Shana, it was great speaking with you. Please keep in touch.
Thank you so much.
Kara Latham is the supervisor of Ella K. McClatchy Branch at Sacramento Public Library. And Shana Garaya is the co-director of Superfest. The Sacramento Superfest is happening this Sunday, January 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. And we have all of that information on our Insight page. And with that, that's it for Insight today. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.